Today on Straight Talk Africa, it's the utopian continent that most Africans say they want. An Africa democratic, united, with social and economic justice for all its people. An Africa without artificial boundaries, inherited from its former colonial powers. And a united Africa governed by visionary leaders responsive to the concerns of their citizens. That's coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington. I am Shaka Sali.
Hello, Shaka, and hello to all our viewers and listeners on the continent and elsewhere. I'm Ian Bior, your social media reporter.
Today, it's a discussion on the Africa that most people want.
And coming up later, you, our audience, have weighed in on our topic through emails, Facebook, and Twitter comments, and we'll reveal some of them ahead on Straight Talk Africa.
For many, African economic development is measured in statistics, which they say are not reflected in their communities or neighborhoods. My colleague, Paul Sisko, has more.
Oxymoron, a figure of speech that produces a seeming self-contradiction, such as a cruel kindness. The simplest definition for oxymoron is a combination of contradictory words with opposite or different meanings. Some familiar favorites are, I'm clearly confused, minor crisis, old news. Certain critics might consider African development an oxymoron. Agenda 2063 is a strategic African development plan and vision for the African continent and her diaspora. Agenda 2063 is a distant echo, reigniting and invigorating the ideas of Dr. Kwame Nkrumah and the founders of the Organization of African Unity. It's a call, a plea, a demand for a united Africa based on self-reliance, with Africans financing Africa's own development and, quote, holding ourselves accountable and our governments and institutions accountable for results. In August 2014, the African Union rededicated itself to that persistent Pan-African vision of an integrated, prosperous, and peaceful Africa, driven by its own citizens and representing a dynamic force in the global arena. Simply put, a prosperous, united, and integrated continent, peaceful and secure, is dependent upon good governance, democracy, respect for human justice, and the rule of law. With those universal values and ethics in place, Africa can be a strong, united, and influential force for good in global affairs and the partner the world of nations desperately needs. It is in an Africa where development is people-driven and only possible when the great potential of its women and youth is unleashed. One where Africans can trade, move, and negotiate freely between its independent nations. A continent determined to eradicate poverty in a single generation, with an educated, gender-equal citizenry able to feed itself and much of the planet, with a world-class infrastructure and modern industrialized economy. Agenda 2063 is a renewed call to action to the African diaspora, the African leadership, and the people of Africa, particularly so its youth. Perhaps Africa's youth, with the rest of Africa, might borrow a slogan from the corporate giant Nike and just do it. Before asking, why Agenda 2063? Why not, with confidence and determination, bring forth the Africa we want now? Paul Sisko, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Paul, for that interesting report. Joining us here in our VOA Washington studio are three distinguished guests. Ni Akwete, African policy analyst and activist. Meli Dube is a Zimbabwean human rights activist who is currently a Hubert Humphrey Fellow at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs, Minneapolis, Minnesota. And last but not least, Maurice Wakakamba, Chief Executive Officer, Agency for Transformation, a Ugandan think tank, and former Special Advisor, Information and Research to the Ugandan President at State House, Entebbe. Well, gentlemen, I have to say frankly that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the three of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much for the privilege.
You're most welcome. Later in the program, we'll give you, the audience, a chance to call and talk with our guests. The number to call is 202-619-3111, and the U.S. country code is 1. Let me come to you immediately. A kid, of course, from Accra, Ghana, where, in fact, when you talk about Black Africa's decolonization, that's where it all started, isn't it?
It did.
March 6, 1957.
Yes, but there was work that led up to it, actually. What we are told is, you know, there was what Nkrumah Osagyefo called positive action. The British did not, you know, I take umbrage when people say Europeans gave Africa independence. No, Africans wrestled it back from the Europeans. They didn't want to give it up.
They demanded it.
They demanded it and took it back. In Ghana, it was mostly through street action and agitation. But in other parts of Africa, it actually had to require armed force. So, yes, it started. And I'm saying March 6 was an unforgettable day, but there was a lot of work for about 15 years under Nkrumah's leadership before we got to that. And even there had been others agitating before he returned from UK and the United States after school. So it took a lot of work for us to get to March 6, 1967, and it did not stop there. One of the first things he did was call the All African People's Conference to bring to activists from the rest of the continent to Accra. I know that some of them were Mr. Nijoma, Mr. Lumumba, a whole lot of other people.
So, 1958, correct?
Yes. And of course, he explained it all by saying that the independence of Ghana is meaningless unless other African countries were independent too.
Incredible. Who were some of his mentors? And these were, in fact, from the diaspora.
Precisely, precisely, because, you know, he came to school in the United States in 1935. And in fact, one anecdote that shines a light for me is that, of all people, Mwalimu Julius Nyerere of Tanzania said something about his relationship with President Nkrumah that, for me, was a very insightful and comment, and it taught me a lot. He said, look, Kwame has been radical, but you have to understand why. I, Julius, I went to school in Scotland. Kwame went
Edinburgh.
To school in Edinburgh. Kwame went to school in the United States. He immersed himself in the diaspora there, the African-American community. His professors were Black giants. And therefore, he had a worldview, not just of African unity, but global unity of people of all African descents. And he was in a hurry. But I'm saying you are totally right that the diaspora was on his mind. This is why W.E.B. Du Bois is buried in Accra. This is why the Great Africa Project was started by George Padmore. He brought in a whole lot of major African leaders, and not just the old ones. I saw Muhammad Ali in Accra and Malcolm X in Accra.
What about the fact that the Ghanaian national football team,
yes,
is in fact called the Black Star? Are we talking about Marcus Agave here?
Oh, of course. Yes, absolutely. And it wasn't even just the Ghanaian football team, but Ghana had early on started a national merchant navy, a company of ships that were plowing the world, and it was called the Black Star Line, just like Marcus Garvey had named his company. So, yes, Marcus Garvey had a huge impact on Nkrumah.
Well, Mary Lee says that they didn't actually have to shoot a single bullet in order to essentially regain their political independence from the British, but there are some other countries that did have to do that. And you happened to come from Zimbabwe the last time I checked.
Yes, definitely.
What about you? How did you get independence?
Yeah, so Zimbabwe was, some of our leaders were inspired by the likes of Kwame Nkrumah. Mugabe, who is one of the nationalist leaders and the current president, actually taught in Ghana to the point of actually marrying a Ghanaian. Yes, the late Sally Mugabe. Mm. So that inspiration actually came all the way, I mean, to the southern part of Africa. So, but it wasn't as easy for the Zimbabweans to gain their independence without shooting, I think we would be in a different space. I don't know. But so a war had to be fought since 1966 to the late 70s, and then the negotiations. Unfortunately, I speak from a very, 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 very close interface with people who went to war, because my father is a war veteran, my mother is a rural farmer, and all these people saw the war. So unfortunately, the people who went to war, they fought the war, and then when they came out of the struggle, they had to form governments, and that had its own negatives, because, you know, you can imagine people coming from a war with all the trauma, with everything, having to form a government, and also having, you know, gone through the pain that gave them a sense of entitlement that we are the only ones who liberated this country. And unfortunately, some of them can't let go now.
Very interesting. Maurice, you may probably be aware of the fact that the founding prime minister of independent Uganda, Dr. Apollo Milton Obote, was also a protege of Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. And guess what? When he gets married to Miria Obote,
yes.
Do you know that he, in fact, took his honeymoon, or spent his honeymoon in Ghana?
Yeah, well, Shaka, really, the thread through all those post-independence leaders or leaders that led to independence of these countries was that it was very much a collaborative process. That they viewed and looked at Africa, if you ask me, as a single entity that needed to be emancipated, that needed to be liberated, and that liberation of just one country was not enough. You know, everybody would be independent, you know, when everybody was actually independent. So countries like Tanzania, you remember Mwalimu Julius Nyerere offered to delay independence of Tanganyika at that time, not until countries like Uganda and Kenya and other neighboring countries was also independent. So I think really those leaders who had adaptively really emerged, you know, at that time, yeah, were very much Pan-Africanists, were very much leather-focused on having this continent united, that was. Because essentially borders were a legacy of colonialists that they were trying to remove. So they wanted to remove these colonialists and their legacy, and borders was part of that. It's very unfortunate that, you know, so many years since then, we are still talking about the borders. We are still talking about, you know, visas, you know, for intra-African countries, that becomes very difficult for an African. It's easier for an African to visit the United States or Europe, but it's not easy to visit a neighboring country because there are still visa restrictions. So that is one of the side things. I mean, a month ago, I was in Malawi traveling with some people from Rwanda, and they couldn't. It was a huge, huge hassle to enter Malawi just because they needed to have sent in an application early to be cleared to be able to apply for a visa to Malawi. And once, if you reach Lilongwe, there is actually a Paul Kagame Street. But, you know, it was very difficult for Rwandans to enter Malawi. And you say perhaps Peter Mutharika and General Paul Kagame should just have a cup of coffee and remove this barrier to Africa's integration, to movement of African peoples around the continent. So there are still these challenges, but again, since then, you also realize that there are a lot of strides that have been achieved in terms of human security, in terms of progress, in terms of peace, in terms of poverty reduction. So there is a lot of progress, and I think we're going to talk about it later in the program.
Very interesting. What about the fact that March 6, 1957, Kwame Nkrumah actually says, rather than say, I have killed my beast, my animal, now it is time to eat. Actually, what he says is that the independence of Ghana would be meaningless unless it is linked with the total liberation of the rest of Africa. And he doesn't simply talk the talk. He actually walks that talk so that the liberation struggles across the continent, in fact, walks the walk. How significant was that?
I think it was hugely significant. I mean, Nkrumah was, in a good sense, a driven personality. He knew what he wanted to do, he knew what he had to do, and he couldn't rest a single day without doing it. And yes, for him, it was entirely the liberation of the entire continent. I remember as far back as the early 60s when he was pushing hard for African unity, and he understood that one of the, even after independence, one of the biggest enemies of Africa is neocolonialism. And the neocolonial countries wanted, I've always thought that they actually appreciate African unity more than a lot of Africans. So they do their best to prevent it. This is why they divided the continent. But Nkrumah always stressed that, look, if we don't liberate the whole continent and we don't unite, we will perish. And they tried to offer counter arguments. This is my point. I remember the British saying at the time, because they were fostering rivalry and enmity between Ghana and Nigeria. And they will say to Nigeria, you are much bigger. Why is little Ghana punching above its weight? Nkrumah is too ambitious. He wants to govern the whole. In fact, I was stunned one time when they wrote that Nkrumah wants to replace European colonialism and imperialism in Africa with colonialism and imperialism by Ghana.
Well, well,
in order to stop him.
Hold it on that. We have to go for a break. Now we'll pause for a short break. We want to remind you that Straight Talk Africa is now streaming on Facebook. Just enter the keyword Straight Talk Africa and watch our show live. And don't forget to share it with your friends. Also, we are on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Shaka. That's VOA Shaka. And join in on today's discussion with your questions and comments. Don't forget to use the hashtag #TheAfricaWeNeed. We'll put some of your tweets on air later in the show. We'll be right back with you, so please, don't go away.
We are able to touch on things that are important to people on an everyday basis. We hope that our viewers are getting inspired when they watch our show. They're getting a view of the world from a different perspective, things that perhaps are not in their immediate vicinity. Today, I could put in on the show something that is a little different, a little unique, and this gives me that inspiration to come to work.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. What is your opinion about today's topic? Call us at 202-619-3111, U.S. country code 1. When you call, remember the following. Ask only one question, keep your comment brief, and turn down the volume on your radio or television. Now let's return to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Gidu Yuwat. And of course, this is Straight Talk Africa coming to you live from Washington. Let me come to you, Mary. You've heard, of course, the debate that you are obviously a part of. Does that perhaps make sense to you as to why there are a lot of pundits who actually go to the extent of saying, given that type of leadership that we were talking about, the founding fathers, as it were, that in fact the future of Africa may in fact be behind it rather than be ahead of it?
I'm not sure if I agree with those pundits, but what I know is that there are leaders who are part of the founding fathers who are still in power. One of them is Robert Mugabe, maybe he might be the only one remaining, I'm not sure. The future of Africa is always ahead of it. And the foundation was laid. And there are things that were taken literal, you know, in the literal sense. When Nkrumah said, seek ye political kingdom and all else shall come unto you. I mean, that was his reality. He knew that the freedom was the only thing that was needed then. But there was more work to be done after independence. There was much, much more work. And that work, some of it has not even started. Some of it has started, and some of it starts and stops. If you look at the initiatives that Obasanjo, Thabo Mbeki, and others came up with recently under NEPAD, things like the African peer review mechanism, those are the things that, that's where Africa is beginning to say, you know what? It's not all about freedom. This is, we need to put a lot of work in it. We need to, check ourselves, check the excesses of power, check the entitlement issue, because, you know, when you liberate a people, then you think you have to hold on to the throne forever at whatever cost, at sometimes, you know, with violence in cases of Zimbabwe. In cases of other countries, there is jailing of journalists. So I don't think there is a format. If you look at all those leaders, you can look at Museveni. Museveni writes a book and he says, you know, what is the problem of Africa? And he rightfully says it's the problem of leadership. And then he goes into power and then he stays into power. He does the same thing that he diagnosed as a problem and he becomes the problem. So now you then realize that, no, these people are human. What is needed are strong institutions, strong opposition parties, strong civil society, strong other, everything else that strengthens citizens so that they can stand up to these leaders and help them, you know, and help their countries realize the dream, the Africa that we want.
The question is, how do you bring about those strong institutions that you're talking about? A little bit earlier, you referred to NEPAD.
Yes.
There was a time, of course, when that was in vogue. They talked about NEPAD.
Yes.
This is definitely going to develop Africa. I believe that the last time I checked, it was probably headquartered in Midlands, South Africa,
yes,
between Pretoria and Johannesburg. But who actually funds NEPAD?
Yeah. So there's funding issues. NEPAD is funded by many donors. I don't know if I have to mention them, but it is not 100% funded by African money. Just like the African Union. If you look at the African Union, it only funds, I mean, countries only fund about 40% of their budget.
What about the headquarters with the love from Beijing?
Yes. So the problem then comes, you know, you get captured by the person who funds you. Yet Africa has all the resources to bankroll its programs. Africa has resources. It has the mineral resources. If you look at the GDPs of these countries, you know, plus the illicit financial flows that go out of Africa every year, every now and then, you can realize that Africa has its own potential to fund 100% its programs.
Mm.
And when they fund their programs or even their institutions, it means they own them. They totally own them, and they can run them the way they want.
Mm.
Unfortunately, when it comes to NEPAD and its programs like the APRM, you'll see that it's a very beautiful program, but there are some countries that are not acceding to it. There are some countries that say, you know, we want sovereignty at all cost, but at the end of the day, it means do not look at what I'm doing. Do not ask me what I'm doing to my people, even if I'm killing my people. It's my own affair. Sovereignty, I mean, is used to block other countries from assisting one another. Yet you are talking about unity, where, you know, when we're brother and sister, we need to tell each other when there is a problem. I don't think there is a village in Africa where people don't believe in advising each other, in telling each other where they think things might improve. So I think people have to adhere to those institutions that they form. If you look at even the human rights institutions in Africa, they are white elephants. The African Human Rights Commission, the Commission on Human Rights, it's a white elephant. If you take the cases there, they just die. That's it. So that's why you see the people resorting to your ICC and other things, and then all the complications come. So I think there is need for... I don't think what is lacking is ideas, but what is lacking is consistency and sticking to an idea when it comes. And they are not takers sometimes, or they are very half-hearted takers, or an idea comes up and then it's not funded and then it dies.
Morrison, when we talk about the African Union, the African Union is supposed to be perhaps one of the key institutions or one of the key drivers, really, of opening up Africa,
yes,
developing Africa. But what kind of power really does it have? Because a lot of people will tell you, yes, it has some teeth. The question is, do those teeth in fact bite, given that it has no sovereignty?
Yeah, I mean, sovereignty can be, you know, a very relative term. It can be incremental, it can be geometric. But if you look at what African Union has been doing, I've been looking at Agenda 2063, you know, a superb document that has very interesting targets. For instance, by 2025, they want to make sure that Africa is free of hand hoists, so we are using technology to transform the African continent. It's really a very inspirational and aspirational document. Yeah, but how it moves to commit the African governments and African leaders and African peoples to actually do the investments to realize its aspirations and objectives, you know, could be another thing. And you find that different countries move on it, you know, quite differently. I mean, the other day I was looking at countries like Ethiopia that have invested so much in energy, and now Ethiopia has surpassed Nigeria as the biggest economy, really, beside South Africa. I think biggest in the continent, because Nigeria, you know, after doing GDP rebasing, actually moved ahead of South Africa. But you know, you're really asking a very interesting question. You know, we have seen some time back where African Union has had the teeth, especially on issue related to coups in Africa.
Exactly.
You know, where some folks and individuals want to grab power unconstitutionally, and you have the African Union coming in to say, wait a minute.
In fact, they even called out the coup in Egypt.
Absolutely.
Where the United States, right here where we are, it couldn't call it a coup.
Yeah, but of course there are other sides of the coin. You remember, like, the situation in Libya. The African Union position was that, you know, the global Western powers should not intervene until the African Union, you know, finishes up its conversations with Libya and try to settle the situation. But you remember, African representatives of the African Union were not even allowed to fly into Tripoli. So there are all those exigencies, you know, and they definitely do, you know, constitute a problem. But the bigger point that I wanted to make is that, you know, really overall, if you look at the African continent, you see a continent transitioning into an opportunity where structural transformation is really beginning to happen. You started the show talking about numbers. But if you look at 1980s and 1990s, the African continent was growing poorer. Why do I say that? It is because the population was growing at a much higher rate than the GDP or the value of economic activity on the continent. But the best year that we can look at that is very important for transformation is 2002. Since 2002, African economies have been growing, or the growth has been over and above the population growth, except for countries like Niger that has the highest, I think, you know, in terms of the, you know, population rate and fertility rates. But for most of other African countries, their population has been growing at a lower pace than its GDP. Of course, Shaka, you know that GDP and growth is not the entire story. You know, where you have GDP numbers, but if you look at the real people and what they put in the pocket is less of the rosy picture put forward. So meaning that you still have problems of inclusive growth. Is this growth that is happening on the African continent actually shared by all African citizens? That is still a major challenge, and I think the African Union has a lot. And how can it do it? There are three areas that has been a subject of a lot of discussion and conversation. The first one is institutions, to build robust institutions to make sure that they deliver fairness, they deliver democracy, they deliver good governance, peace and security across the continent.
When you're talking about institutions,
yes.
Could you please be specific? Are you talking about, for example, inbuilt checks and balances?
Absolutely, that's what I'm talking about, to make sure that government functions to deliver a democratic state, a capable state, but also checks and balances to make sure that rule of law really happens. That's what I mean by institution, and that they should cut across, if it is the East African community, an independent judiciary, independent electoral commissions. All those are very important institutions that will make sure that you have inclusive growth, that you have inclusive participation, that you have, you know, governance that is driven, that people are at the center of governing their own countries. That's going to be very important. The second aspect is integration. How do you make integration work? I started by talking about the legacy of borders. I started by talking about there is no single African visa to go to Ghana, to go to South Africa. You stand in the line waiting for a visa to go to South Africa.
Even the headquarters of the African Union itself in Ethiopia.
In Ethiopia. That cannot be happening. And that's not a problem of state capacity, Shaka. That's a problem of lack of will
political will
by the leaders. I think that's really a big problem. Also, unharmonization of all these legal and policy regimes, that it's very difficult to open up a business in Nigeria. If you're Ugandan, Dangote was complaining that it's very, very difficult for him because once he wants to open up in Tanzania or another country, he needs to go back to an area of over 70, you know, legislations or policies that need to be harmonized for him to be able to open a business. You know, mobility of African, you know, intellectual resources into different countries. The brain trust of Africa cannot move. And so all of those are very serious challenges that African Union may need to deal with, but there is light at the end of the tunnel.
Unfortunately, Maurice, there's no democracy in Studio 52. Yeah. I have to go. You're tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment, including our social media segment. So please, don't go away.
Today's youth are not just the next generation of African leaders. They are today's leaders. And this is the time to invest in them, today, not tomorrow. So let's connect, let's engage with each other on issues that will transform our societies.
Innovation, leadership, entrepreneurship, things that you're doing to move the continent forward to make you the greatest generation that Africa has known.
It's Upfront every Wednesday, 1730 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
This is Straight Talk Africa on The Voice of America. Call us now with your questions and comments. The number is 202-619-3111 and the U.S. country code is 1. Call us direct and we'll call you right back. Remember to turn down the volume on your radio or television and keep your comments brief. Now back to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Githy Ewart, and welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, live from Washington. It's time to bring in my colleague and social media reporter, Ayen Bior. Take it away, Ayen.
Well, thanks, Shaka. Today we examine where things stand in Africa in terms of good governance, the rule of law, social and economic justice for all. We are also exploring what policies can be adopted to move the continent forward. This leads us to our question of the week, which asks, what is one thing that should be done so we can have the Africa we need? Well, before we begin, I'd like to thank all of you for using all our social media platforms to communicate with us. And another reminder that we are tweeting live today. Use the hashtag #TheAfricaWeNeed. And if you haven't yet, please follow us at VOA Shaka. Speaking of it, let's go to a tweet from Marcelo Ali in Uganda, who tweets, we should have leaders who think about the population and not the general election. And we have another tweet from Clement Dlamini from Swaziland who tweets, we need African-driven development with less talk, less tokenism, and strong leadership with homegrown solutions. Very interesting. Well, now to our comment of the week from Facebook fan Paul Nabita from Lusaka in Zambia. He writes, we need to set up a system where the president is not constitutionally allowed to elect government officials like the chief justice or the electoral body. We have presidents abusing these people because they feel he has given them a job and they will do anything to please him. They totally forget that they are there for the people. Very interesting. Well, let's go to another comment from Facebook fan Tingbati Matthew Saboba from Ghana, who writes, education for all. Make formal education accessible, affordable, and progressive to all school-age children, and promote informal education. Very interesting. And our last Facebook comment comes from William Kakulo of Monrovia, who writes, remove all dictators and thieves and make the system work. Our political class should begin sending their children to local schools in their respective countries, instead of the British and American system. Our political class should have faith in the doctors they boast of training in their higher institutions of learning, instead of running to Europe, America, and India when they are sick. Now, a reminder that we appreciate all of the audience feedback, so please keep them coming. If you're a new fan, drop us a line at africatv@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is africatv@voanews.com, or post your comment on our Facebook page. Enter the keywords Straight Talk Africa. interact with our show as it's streaming live. Be sure to visit us online at voaafrica.com, or you can join our YouTube channel. Sign up to VOA TV 2 Africa. And follow us on Twitter at VOA Shaka. A reminder that the show is streaming live every Wednesday. Go to VOA Straight Talk Africa TV program page on our website, or you can simply watch us live on your mobile device. Just download the VOA mobile app. Now let's take a look at what's on tap for next week's program. On the next Straight Talk Africa, a look at the challenges facing women and girls in Africa on their road to empowerment. We'll examine the current situation and look ahead at the way forward on the next Straight Talk Africa. Well, that's all for today's social media segment. Shaka, you and the guests have a lot of social media comments to get to discuss. Back to you.
Thanks a lot, Ayen, for sharing the social media reaction with us. And welcome back. And of course, today, it's a discussion on the Africa that most people want. Our distinguished guests are Ni Akwete, Mary Duve, and Morrison Wakakamba. Gentlemen, once again, I have to say that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to interact with you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you, Shaka. Thank you.
Thank you, Shaka.
You're most welcome. Your reaction? You heard it all from Ayen.
Yes, I think the comments, especially about the one thing that needs to be done in order to move Africa forward, were very interesting. Of course, they ranged all over the. There were different issues. The one that stuck with me was the one about leaders. Get rid of the leaders and the thieves. Mm. And I happen to think that the way you do that is to have democracy, but, you know, democracy properly defined, you know, institutions, checks and balances. Yes, independence, judiciary, the media. And it was also interesting that somebody said, I'm still wrestling with that president should be barred from appointing key people like the Chief Justice and others because these people think that they owe the president. We have to find ways of containing them, which means we have to build institutions. The one thing I want to add about institutions, and of course, my brothers here had mentioned, I mean, Museveni's book where he talks about, he says the problem is leadership. I keep thinking that to a certain extent it is. But my worry is that we should not rely on leaders to say, we should not just say we will leave it to them to police themselves. We should not even look for leaders who we say, quote unquote, have good hearts. I think we have to build institutions that are what keep leaders behaving properly. After decades in this country, that is what I have come to believe. It's not that the politicians themselves are special, but there are institutions that hold them accountable. And so we need to be building institutions that will hold our leaders accountable. And the other thing that I think we need to reflect on about leadership and institutions is that we should not expect the leaders themselves to build the institutions. From their personal point of view, the institutions are not in their interest. They want democracy when they are out of power. Once they get into power, they think democracy is a nuisance. Mm-hmm. So we have to look outside of them to build checks and balances that frustrate them, that curtail their power, a vigorous press. And so, of course, if the leaders are not the ones to build the institutions, who must build them? I happen to think it has to be activists. It has to be the people who step forward. But for goodness sakes, let us not assume that the leaders will build institutions. They see the institutions as their enemies.
Yeah, but what about the fact that, Mary, there are some people who are very skeptical about whether, in fact, what Africa needs is democracy. There are people who pretty much don't see, frankly, what it represents in terms of developing the continent. They point, for example, to China. China, the last time I checked, has no democracy. And yet, it seems to be developing, isn't it?
Yes. So I think, like my brothers mentioned initially, that, you know, growth and economic development is not everything that people need. So China is developing, but you know that China has no freedom. They still have laws that restrict civil society or NGOs working in their countries. There are still journalists that are arrested. There are still researchers that are arrested. And also, there is no free... The leaders are not chosen by the people, literally. So at the end of the day, who do they account to? Because you account to the person that chose you. You account to the institution that put you in power. So I have a huge problem with anyone who says democracy does not work, putting development... Because these two should not be viewed separately. These two should be viewed as a complementary concepts. That's why there is this talk now of a democratic developmental state, a state that is both developmental and democratic. It takes, aspects of being developmental in the fact that, you know, it has institutions that are strong, that drive development. But at the same time, there is the procedure of democracy. Leaders are elected by the people. They come in via a democratic process. They retain legitimacy, not via force. They retain legitimacy because people chose them and they gave them the mandate. So at the end of the day, if a leader wants to come through a process that does not go via the people, he's not going to account to the people. And I like the point that you mentioned that, you know, there are government institutions, the separation of power and other things that we're talking about that we need. But what we need more is a very strong citizen who organizes. The civil society is one set of, structure or sector in society that has to be strong. And people have to organize from their local villages and everything and not accept any leader that, you know, just pushes them from pillar to post and just imposes their will on them. And that should be built up from the grassroots level to the national level. So that, you know, those institutions, because I can give an example of Zimbabwe. We have a new constitution that we adopted in 2013. One of the best constitutions. It's almost word for word South African constitution and a bit of Kenyan constitution. But guess what? That constitution is not being followed. Precisely because it does not take what you said. It's not the goodness of the leader that will make them do well. Because even if you give them the best of institutions, they'll water down their powers. They will destroy them. They will disregard them. Even if you look at the United States, the current president, of course, I see it in the media every day. You see the American media being blockaded from attending a press conference in one of his foreign trips. Yeah. And those are some of the strong institutions, the media, that should hold leaders to account.
But the strong institutions here do seem to work.
Yes.
Now, talking about civil society, there was a time, frankly, when the civil society in Zimbabwe was one of the most vibrant on the continent. What happened?
A lot of things happened, Chaga. A lot of things happened. But maybe to step back a little bit, the American system did not work by itself. It worked because the citizens worked on it to work. There's a lot of organizing. If you go deep into the grassroots, into the communities of Americans, even I think you can attest to that. So in Zimbabwe, yes, we had a strong civil society at some point, especially in the mid-2000 to the late 2000, precisely to around 2008. And then there was an inclusive government. And then the inclusive government lasted its course, and civil society during that time didn't know what to do. Some civic leaders joined the government. Some civic leaders, I suppose, stepped back and thought, this thing is now a given. We are now on course in terms of the transition of Zimbabwe. After this, we'll have democracy. And then some donors also disengaged with civil society and engaged with government, thinking that, you know, we have to directly support government and strengthen government. And then that... So those are some of the things that weaken the civil society that we see today in Zimbabwe. But I must say that it's not totally destroyed. There is still leaders of civil society that exist in Zimbabwe and that are pushing, that are working day in and day out. But, Chaka, your question speaks to a huge philosophical departure, you know, of how our leaders have conceptualized their authoritarianism, especially in Zimbabwe. It has become so sophisticated that sometimes they ignore you. Sometimes they only become, they confront you when you are coming to them hard and fast.
And sometimes they steal elections without a trace, without even a trace.
Mm.
And they retain some bit of legitimacy in the world. And then civil society can't even prove that this election was stolen. For instance, in the 2013 elections in Zimbabwe, it's very difficult to prove. But we all know that it didn't go well. And, you know, there's some African countries, obviously, that will recognize ZANU-PF. There's some European countries that have been tired of watching China trading with Africa while they stand on the sidelines, that remove some of the sanctions, taking away the pressure of the dictatorship and so forth. So all those things weaken the civil society because it strengthens the dictatorship.
Morrison, we have a Facebook follower here called Cesar Chona from Zambia. He asks, what is Africa at large doing to countries that do not respect the rule of law? This obviously must be a hypothetical question that probably requires a hypothetical answer, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I do agree that, you know, there are two levels where you have got, you know, continental sanctions, you know, for countries that are engaged in lawlessness. And the African Union should definitely have a law. But the bigger point is that the guarantors of rule of the law across Africa are the people. So if institutions that don't have people at the center cannot survive the storms.
Mm, mm, mm.
And Africans, by the way, cannot expect, you know, external forces or what you call, you know, exogenous forces to be the ones to come and transform their countries or their own neighbors to transform their own countries. It is the citizenship or the citizenry of those countries that must be able to organize, that must be able to participate, that must be able to access information, that must be able to hold their own leaders accountable. And this brings me to really this point of leadership. I think there comes a lot of confusion between, you know, authority figures who are presidents, who are prime ministers, you know, and leaders. Authority figures are there because they are put there by people. Although, when it's time for distress, you know, usually people look to these authority figures for answers or scapegoat. You know, when citizens also try to escape their own responsibilities, they scapegoat and put the blame on these authority figures. So there has to be a distinction, and we should realize that these authority figures can be leaders, some can be leaders, and serve the public interest and public good. But the leaders and the leadership should be looked at really through the prism of everybody, the civil society, okay, the churches, the traditional leaders, and all segments of the society, the teachers, the fathers, the husbands, the local leaders, the local chairpersons in their own communities are all leaders who every day should wake up and do something important that feeds into the greater goal of the country, into the greater goal of the continent. And this is where I also have challenges with this African Union Agenda 23, you can see that whereas it has these grand and fantastic ideas, it has not moved further to mobilize the people to be the guarantors, to be the perpetrators of development or of achieving the purpose and objectives of Agenda 2063. That's a major challenge.
Now, when you talk about people vis-a-vis the African Union, when you crisscross the African continent and you actually talk to people, are you surprised that a lot of these people, frankly, do not have any relationship with this institution? In fact, a lot of them don't even know it exists.
Yeah, it's really because of the, you know, top-heavy mechanistic approaches in management, where people sit in Addis Ababa and think this is what is the best, you know, for the African continent. You see, most of these ideas, generation and crafting of the purpose should be very much adaptive, that starts from our villages, that starts from our local churches, that starts from the communities, and form the national agenda that then feeds into the African Union. So these ideas should really be ground up. Although it's a very expensive game and a very uncertain game, it is necessary if it is to create the impact that we need. So there has to be a shift or rebalancing from the top-heavy mechanistic approach from Addis Ababa to a ground-up from a Nyibingo village somewhere in southwestern Uganda where ideas should emerge and converge, really, at that, you know, at the continental level. So that is how you have the people driving these processes. That is how you have people supporting the national budgets for investing in these plans. And
Of course, there are other cross-border and transnational challenges that have to be addressed by the African Union. You know, Africa contributes 5% of the global greenhouse gas emissions. And issues of environment and climate change really should be seriously managed by the African Union. Mm. You have conflict, you know, across, you know, the Sahel and Central Africa Republic and all these transnational challenges. And the African Union should even play a role, not of just peace building, but of making sure that peace to be built really exists. They should invest more in preventive mechanisms for conflict instead of spending a lot of resources on trying to create peace where there is already conflict. Africa is still experiencing problems like food insecurity, really. Food insecurity, hunger, and malnutrition, you know, across the board. And I mean, these are very serious issues that shows where we are at, because for all these years, the post-independent, we shouldn't be talking of countries that cannot feed themselves, that cannot participate in higher global value chains. Those challenges are there, but of course I also know that in some areas like ICT, you find that ICT innovations, you know, are beginning to emerge in Africa, you know, in Kenya, where young people are the ones who are leading some of these processes, and in other countries. Yes, there is where you find positives, pockets of excellence, positives of, you know, success. But I think overall, we still have structural challenges. The other day I was looking at this very important example of structural transformation. Africa is known as a continent that is using mobile phones. And the mobile phone penetration is almost the highest, you know, across.
Right.
So that consumerism is very important and it leads to development. But the bigger aspect is a phone is made by 60 parts. How many parts of that phone are manufactured in Africa or manufactured by Africans?
And yet the raw material, especially coltan and what have you,
comes from the Democratic Republic of Congo and South Africa and all those places.
Yeah.
So structural transformation really happens when Africans actually begin to manufacture, because that is where jobs are, that is where skills transfer.
That is very interesting because these United States of America that we are living in right now actually began heavy industrialization after 50 years. And most of African countries have actually been independent for more than 50 years. But we don't even have anything like adding value to anything. Let's go to at least the lifeline of the show, and that is the telephone callers. We have a guest called Francis from the Republic of Uganda. Good evening, Francis. You're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Right. Yes, Dr. Shakashale, I'm grateful to be on the show.
You're most welcome.
My submission is, I'm calling live from Jinja, which is used to be the heart of this country, Uganda. Now, African leaders are the root cause of every underdevelopment in every country in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
That is my view. Why? Because a country like Uganda, endowed with all the lakes we have, Lake Albert, we have Lake Choga, we have Lake Victoria, but there is no political will to fight this food insecurity. Poverty is still killing people around this Busoga region. There is no government will to say, let's have irrigations, empower people, because the government believes poor people can easily be ruled. My question is, Dr. Shakashale.
Good evening, sir.
To what extent is a genuine unit? To me, I feel it is a fine hand of dictators in Africa fighting for their own political ambition.
Thank you very much, Francis. I'm afraid that some of the things that Francis said, you could not quite discern them because there was some kind of static on the line. But I think you got the essence, really, of what he was talking about.
Yes.
You're talking about Uganda, where, by the way, the Ugandan president actually was quoted as saying, I don't know whether it is accurate, that he is not a servant of the people, of anybody. And yet, frankly, I like to think that presidents, in fact, happen to be servants of the people.
Shaka, I couldn't agree with you more. You know, in the when we were waiting backstage, Melly and I, you know, we were chatting, and we talk about what does leadership mean. I happen to think, if it is true that President Museveni says that he's a leader and not a servant of the people, then that's one more issue where I disagree with him.
That he's a freedom fighter.
Right. Because I think...
And other sources, in fact, have quoted him. I don't know, again, whether it is accurate.
Yes.
That he is only there to serve his family, his children, and his grandchildren.
Another aspect of what we said was that, you know, in a democracy, people... The great thing about democracy is that people are allowed to exchange views and disagree, even close friends. So that is important to me to say, yes, I don't mind disagreeing with the Ugandan president on that issue. I don't think that he's the head of Uganda only to serve himself or only to serve his family. If that is the case, he should be the head of his family. He's the head of a country with dozens of millions of people. If I'm not mistaken, about 30 million people. He's supposed to look to their interest and protect them, and he is indeed a servant of the people. For me, the essence of definition, and it was mentioned that leadership is not just the politicians, you know, teachers, activists, all of us who claim some mantle of leadership, we need to understand our job is to serve the people and to serve at their pleasure.
In fairness, Mr. Museveni is a very smart guy.
Yes.
Maybe he was actually misquoted.
Yes.
Or he misspoke.
Yes, yes. All that is true. But in any case, you know, in Ghana, there is a saying that nobody has, no matter how brilliant a person is, they don't have control of 100% of the truth. Because so even brilliant people can make mistakes.
Well, I guess we're coming to the end of the show, really. What about the role of social media and the changing demographics in as far as the future of Africa is concerned, really?
Yes. So I was listening when Morrison was talking about, you know, Africa consuming these ICT products from the world, that, you know, it's not only that Africa has to make the phones themselves, but it's about what we're doing with those phones, what they've enabled us to do, how much they've connected us, how much they've made us, how much they've made markets accessible to farmers, are farmers able to market their products? Is my mother, who is a rural farmer, able to, because she's on WhatsApp, I talk to her every day, is she able to use that phone for economic advancement? Is she able to market her things through that? So at the end of the day, you see, you know, the Stalin and the chicken problem at the end of the day, where citizens themselves have been they've been disempowered so much by their leaders that they've lost their dignity. And even though they have those tools, they don't own the land. They cannot farm. They cannot market. So they can only use those gadgets just to communicate and so forth. But I think it presents a lot of potential. And young people, the youth bulge. And
unfortunately, time happens not to be our best ally. Others would have probably talked about, among other things,
no problem,
Mupesa in Kenya. It seems to be making a huge difference in banking. Uh-huh. Well, on that note, thanks to our distinguished guests, Ni Akwete, Mary Dube, and Morrison Wakakamba.
Thank you.
Thanks to our field stations, along with our viewers and listeners, we thank you for tuning in. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning, it's Daybreak Africa with James Bate. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not beta Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.